Musser protectively, without volition. He realized he had done that. Reflex. Protective reflex, he thought. Suddenly, Tim Hamner grinned in the dark. "Why the hell not?" he said aloud, and went to sleep. There was a great tinge to the sky when they both woke. They sat up together, wrapped in thoughts and memories, wondering what had wakened them. Then they heard it over the drumming of rain on metal. A motor, a car or truck, coming very fast up the highway. Presently, there were lights behind them. Tim felt a terrible sense of urgency. He ought to be doing something. Warning. He ought to warn that car. He shook his head violently, trying to shake himself awake. It must have worked. He reached past Eileen for the steering wheel. The horn shrieked in mechanical terror. The car went past them like a bat out of hell, followed by the terror sound. Tim released the horn and heard real mechanical terror. A long scream of brakes, and then nothing. No sound at all for crawling eons. Then metal smashed rock, and light flared ahead of them. They got out and ran toward half a bridge. Below the bridge's twisted end was fire. Fire crawled away from the greater blaze, stopped, convulsed, then fell still. The car burned, casting its bonfire light on the canyon and the stream at its bottom. Tim felt Eileen's hand seeking his. He took her hand and held it tightly. "Poor bastards," she muttered. She shivered in the dawn cold. The rain had eased, but the wind was cold. It blew the fire. They could feel warmth from the blazing car fighting the wind's chill. Eileen let go of Tim's hand and moved out onto the ruined bridge. She looked back at the walls of the gorge on the side where Tim still stood. Then she pointed. "We can get across, I think," she said. "Come look." Her voice was calm and detached now. Tim went out to her, walking gingerly, afraid the rest of the bridge would collapse. He looked where she was pointing. There was a gravel road, barely a car's width wide, carved out of the side of the gorge and switchbacking down into the canyon. "Must be the old road," Eileen said. "I thought there might be one." It didn't look adequate at all, not even to walk on. But Eileen went back and started the engine. "Shouldn't we wait for more light?" Tim asked. "Probably, but I don't want to," she said. "Okay, but let me drive. You get out and walk." There was just light enough to see her face. She leaned over and kissed him lightly on the cheek. "You're sweet, but I'm a better driver than you. And you'll walk, because somebody has to go ahead and be sure I can drive down the trail." "No, we'll do it together." He knew he wasn't making much sense, and he wondered if he would have said that if he hadn't known she would make him get out and walk. "We both have a better chance if you scout," she said. "Now get to it." The old road was a nightmare. Sometimes it tilted horribly toward the canyon below. At least, Tim thought, we're out of sight of the burning car. He could still see some light from the dying blaze. At the switchbacks, she had to go around in short segments, backing up and turning, again and again, with the wheels only inches from the edge. Tim felt terror at every turn. She had only to make one mistake, the wrong gear, or too much pressure on the accelerator, and she would be down there, burning alive, and Tim would be alone. He was barely able to walk when they reached the bottom. "How deep is it?" Eileen asked. Tim came back to the car and got in. "I'll find out in a minute." He reached for her desperately. She pushed him away. "Sweetheart, look." She pointed to her left. There was just enough light to see. Beyond the ruins of the burned car rose a massive concrete wall, rising high above them. A dam. Tim shuddered. Then he got out and waded into the stream, fighting the current. It was only up to his knees, and he staggered across, then beckoned for her to follow. The Landlord. Ownership is not only a right, it is a duty. Ownership obligates. Use your property as if it had been entrusted to you by the people. Oswald Spengler. Thoughts. At noon, Tim and Eileen reached the top of the gorge. When they were a third of the way up, another car had come to the other side and begun working its way down. It was an ordinary car without four-wheel drive, and Tim did not understand how they had got that far up the canyon. The other car held two men, a woman, and many children. It was still clinging to the side of the gorge when Tim and Eileen reached the top on the other side. They drove away, leaving the others perched on the side of the cliff, wondering if they should have spoken to them, but not knowing what they could have done to help. Tim felt more helpless than ever. He was prepared for the end of civilization, to be nearly alone, to find human beings few and far between. He was not prepared to watch it die, and he wondered what he should do about that, but he could think of nothing. The next bridge was mercifully intact, and the one after that. They were only a few miles from the observatory. They rounded a bend to find four cars in the road. There were a lot of people standing there. These were the first people Tim and Eileen had seen since they left the gorge. The road ran through a tunnel here, and the tunnel had collapsed. The cars were parked while men with shovels worked to prepare a way over the top of the rocky spur the tunnel had pierced. They had dug out part of a road and were taking turns, since there were more men than shovels. Six women and many children were gathered around the cars. Eileen looked hesitantly at the group, then drove up to them. The children stared with big eyes. One of the women came over to the car. She seemed ancient, although she couldn't have been more than 40. She looked at the blazer, noting the starred bullet hole in the rear windshield. She didn't say anything. "Hello," Tim said.
"Hi."
"Have you been here long?"
"Got here just after dawn,"
the woman said. "Did you come from town?" Eileen asked.
"No, we were camped up here. Tried to get back to Glendale, but the road's blocked. How'd you get up here? Could we go back the way you came?"
Once she had found her voice, the woman talked rapidly.
"We came up Big Tahunga," Tim said.
The woman looked surprised and turned to the hill.
"Hey, Freddy, they came up Big Tahunga."
"It's blocked," the man called.
He handed the shovel to another man and started down the hill toward them. Tim saw that he wore a pistol on his belt. Their cars were not very new. A battered pickup truck loaded with camping goods, a station wagon on sagging springs, an ancient Dodge Dart.
"We tried to get out Big Tahunga," the man was saying as he came closer. He wore typical camping clothing, wool shirt and twill trousers.
A Sierra cup dangled from one side of his belt. The pistol hung in its holster on the other. He didn't seem to be aware of the gun.
"I'm Fred Haskins. Reckon you came across the gorge by the old switchbacks?"
"Yes," Eileen said.
"What's it like back in L.A.?"
Haskins asked. "Bad," Tim said.
"Yeah, earthquake shook the place pretty good, huh?"
Haskins looked at Tim carefully. He looked at the bullet hole, too.
"How'd you get that?"
"Someone tried to stop us."
"Where?"
"Just as we started up the mountains," Tim said.
"Sheriff's Honor Farm," Haskins muttered. "All them prisoners loose, then."
"What did you mean, bad?" the woman asked. "What did you mean?"
Suddenly Tim couldn't stand it any longer.
"It's all gone. The San Fernando Valley, everything south of the Hollywood Hills, drowned in a tidal wave. What wasn't drowned is burned. Tahunga looked pretty good, but the rest of L.A. Basin is finished."
Fred Haskins stared uncomprehendingly.
"Finished? All those people dead? All of them?"
"Just about," Tim said.
"There are probably a lot of people still alive in the hills," Eileen said, "but if the road's blocked, then they can't come up here."
"Jeez," Haskins said. "That comet hit us, right? I knew it was going to hit. Martha, I told you we'd be better up here. How long? I guess they'll send the army to get us, but we may as well dig our way over," Haskins said. "Road on the other side looks in good shape, far as we can see anyway. Martha, you got anything on the radio yet?"
"Nothing. Static. Sometimes I think I hear a few words, but they don't make sense."
"Yeah."
"You folks had anything to eat?" Martha Haskins asked.
"No."
"You look starved. Here, I'll get you something, Mr. Tim. Tim, and you're... Eileen, thank you. Yeah, Tim, you go with Fred there and help dig while I get lunch together.
As they climbed up the steep trail, Fred said,
Glad you came along. Not sure we could have got all the cars over. With that rig, you can pull them over for sure. Then we'll go look for the army people.
The road heaved and shifted and moved out from under the lead truck. Corporal Gillings, dozing in his seat, was jarred nastily awake. Swearing, he looked out through the canvas. The convoy was trapped. The earth heaved like a sea.
Hammerfall, he said.
The troops were muttering. Johnson asked,
What's that? The end of the fucking world, you dumb motherfucker. Don't you read anything?
Gillings had read it all. The National Enquirer, articles in Time, the interviews with Sharps and others. He had planned it all 1,000 times, daydreaming in his bunk, adding loving details to the scenario. Gillings knew what would happen when Lucifer's hammer fell. End of civilization, and the end of the goddamn army, too. It would be every man for himself, and the right man could be a fucking king if he played his cards right. Johnson was staring, bewildered and lost, waiting to hear more. Gillings felt lightheaded, disoriented. He was not used to seeing his daydreams turn real. Captain Hora called,
Out of the trucks! Everybody out!
Gillings's head cleared. Right. It was all falling into place, and that was the first problem. Fucking officers. Hora wasn't bad, as officers went, and the men liked him. Something had to be done about that, and quick. Otherwise, the R.A. son of a bitch would have them out working like slaves, trying to save the civilians' arses until fire and tidal waves took them all.
"We're trapped good, Captain!"
Sergeant Hooker shouted.
"Landslides in front and behind. Don't think we can get the trucks out of here."
"Saddle 'em up, Sarge," Captain Hora called. "We'll hike it. Plenty of people up in these hills. We'll go see what we can do."
"Sir,"
Hooker said. His voice lacked enthusiasm.
"What do we eat, Captain?"
"Time enough to worry about that when we get hungry," Hora said. Go have a look up ahead. Maybe we can get through the mud.
Sir.
Rest of you, out of the trucks, Hora called.
Gillings grinned. Damned lucky we didn't get back to camp before Hammerfall. He smiled again and fingered the hard objects in his pocket. The troops hadn't been given ammunition, but it wasn't hard to come by, and he had 12 rounds. There was plenty more ammo in the trucks. Would the men follow him? Maybe not. Not at first. Maybe it would be better to let Hooker live. The troops would follow Hooker, and Hooker wasn't smart, but he was smart enough to know there wasn't any point in arresting Gillings after the captain bought it. No more courts, Marshal. No more courts. Sure, Hooker was that smart. Gillings slipped 3 rounds into his rifle. It took most of the day. Tim had never worked so hard in his life. He'd paid for his lunch. They dug out the steep parts, then used the blazer to break trail, used it again to pull the other cars up the muddy road they'd built. The rain continued, although it was now not much more than a heavy drizzle. Every muscle in Tim's body ached before they were over the ridge. The temporary road didn't have to climb more than 100 feet. But the road they built switchbacked 5 times that in length. When they reached the pavement on the other side of the ruined tunnel, they went in caravan. 4 miles beyond the ruined tunnel, they came to a ranger station. There were hundreds of people there. A church group with 90 children and a few college students as counselors and 1 elderly preacher. Campers and fishing parties had come out of the fire trails and backwoods areas. A bicycling party of French co-eds, only 1 with any English at all, and nobody else spoke French. 1 large camper which held a writer, his wife, and an unbelievable number of children. The rangers had set up a temporary camp. When Tim's party drove up, they were directed off to 1 side. Tim wanted to go on, but a green Forest Service truck blocked the way. Eileen stopped, and they got out. A uniformed ranger had been talking with Fred Haskins. Now he came over to Tim and Eileen. The ranger was in his middle 20s, a lanky, well-muscled man. His uniform gave him a look of authority, but he didn't seem very confident. "They say you came up the Big Tahunga Road," he said. He stared at Tim. "You're Hamner." "I'm not advertising it," Tim said. "No, I don't suppose you are," the ranger said. "Can we get down the Big Tahunga Road?" "Don't you know?" Tim asked. "Look, mister, there are four of us here, and no more. We're trying to take care of these kids. We've got parties out getting people in from dangerous campsites. There are mudslides all over, and most of the bridges are out. We didn't try to get beyond the tunnel when we saw it was down."
"And there's nothing on the radio?" Eileen asked.
"Nothing from the Big Tahunga station," the ranger admitted. "Don't know why. We did get something on CB from some people over at Trail Canyon. They say the big bridge is out, and some people are trapped in the canyon."
"The bridge is out," Eileen said.
"We got across on the old road. There were some people behind us trying to do the same thing when we left."
"You didn't stay to help?" the ranger demanded.
"There were more of them than us," Tim said. "And what good could we do? You can't pull cars on that road. Too many turns. It's not really a road anyway."
"Yeah, I know. We keep it as a foot trail," the ranger said absently.
"Look, you're an expert on comets. Just what has happened? What should we do with these people?"
Tim was ready to laugh at the question, but the ranger's face stopped him. The young man looked too strained, too close to panic, and much too glad to see Tim Hamner. He wanted an expert to give him instructions. Some expert.
"You can't go back to Los Angeles," Tim said. "There's nothing there. Tidal waves took out most of the city."
"Jesus, we got something from Mount Wilson on that, but I didn't believe it."
"And a lot of the rest of it was on fire. Tahunga's got some kind of vigilante group organized. I don't know if they'd be glad to see you or not. The road back to Tahunga's not too bad, but I don't think ordinary cars can get over parts of it, even if you get past the gorge."
"Yeah, but where's the army?" the ranger demanded. "The National Guard. Somebody. You say we shouldn't go back to Tahunga, but what do we do with these kids? We'll run out of food in another day, and we've got a couple of hundred kids to take care of."
Hell, Tim thought. I am the expert. The knowledge produced elation and depression, oddly mixed.
"Okay, I didn't get out to JPL, so I don't know, but I know the comet calved a number of times. It..."
"Calved?"
"Broke up. Came on like a swarm of flying mountains, you understand? It must have hit us in pieces. No telling how many, but..."
"It was morning in California, and the comet came out of the sun, so the main target area was the Atlantic."
"Probably. If the East Coast got tidal waves as big as the one we got, they wiped out everything east of the Catskills, and most of the Mississippi Valley. No more national government. Maybe no more army."
"Jesus Christ! You mean the whole country's gone?"
"Maybe the whole world," Tim said.
It was too much. The ranger sat down on the ground next to Tim's car. He stared into space.
"My girl lives in Long Beach."
Tim didn't say anything.
"And my mother, she was in Brooklyn visiting my sister. You say that's all gone?"
"Probably," Tim said. "I wish I knew more, but probably."
"So what do I do with all the kids and all the campers, with all these people? How do I feed them?"
"You don't," Tim thought, but he didn't say that.
"Food warehouses, cattle ranches, any place there's food until you can plant more crops. It's June. Some of the crops should have survived."
"North,"
the ranger said to himself.
"There are ranches in the hills above Grapevine. North."
He looked up at Tim.
"Where are you going?"
"I don't know. North, I guess."
"Can you take some of the kids?"
"I suppose so, but we don't have anything to eat."
"Who does?"
the ranger demanded.
"Maybe you ought to stay with us. We can all move out together."
"There's probably a better chance for small groups than large ones, and we don't want to stay with you," Tim said. He didn't want to be bothered with kids either, but there was no way to refuse. Besides, it was the right thing to do. He'd read it somewhere. in any ethical situation, the thing you want least to do is probably the right action, or something like that. The ranger went off and came back a few minutes later with 4 young children, ages 6 and under. They were clean and well-dressed and very frightened. Eileen packed them into the back of the Blazer, then got in the back seat where she'd be close to them. The ranger gave Tim a page torn from his notebook. There were names and addresses on it. "This is who the kids are," his voice fell. "If you can find their parents." "Yeah," Tim said. He started the Blazer. It was the first time he'd ever driven it. The clutch was very stiff.
"My name's Eileen." She was sitting in the back. "And that's Tim." "Where are we going?"
the girl asked. She seemed very small and helpless, but she wasn't crying. The boys were.
"Are you taking us to my mommy?"
Tim glanced at the paper. Lori Malcolm, sent to a church camp by her mother. No father mentioned. Mother's address, Long Beach. Lord, what could they tell her?
"Can we go home?"
one of the boys asked before Eileen could say anything. How do you tell a 6-year-old that his home has been washed away, or a little girl that her mommy is?
"We're going up that hill," Eileen said.
She pointed toward the mountain nearby.
"When we get there, we'll wait for your mommy." "But what happened?"
the boy asked.
"Everybody was so scared. Reverend Tilly didn't want us to know it, but he was." "It was the comet,"
Lori told him solemnly.
"Did it hit Long Beach, Eileen? Can I call you Eileen? Reverend Tilly says you aren't supposed to call grown people by their first names, ever."
Tim turned off onto the side road leading up to the observatory. Long ago he'd had the old dirt road improved with logs and gravel and concrete in the worst places. The mud was thick, but the Blazer had no trouble. It wouldn't be long now. Then they'd have food, and they could stop running. For a while, anyway. The food wouldn't last forever, but it would be time enough to worry about that when they got there. Just now, the observatory was home, a haven, a familiar place with heat and dry clothes and a shower, a safe place to hide while the world ended. The Blazer was no longer new and shiny. It was scratched along the sides from rock slides, and there was mud everywhere. It took the muddy road like a freeway, climbing over fallen rock, wading through deep pools. Tim had never had a car like this. It made him feel he could go anywhere. And it had taken them home, around one more bend. One more bend, and they'd be safe. The concrete building stood unharmed. So did the wooden garage outside it. The shed roof of the garage sagged, leaning at an angle, but not so much that anyone but Tim would notice. The telescope dome was closed, and the shutters were in place on all the windows of the main building. "We're here!" Tim shouted. He had to shout. Eileen had the children singing in the back seat. "There's a hair on the wart on the..." "There it is! Safe! At least for a while." The song cut off raggedly.
"It looks all right," Eileen said.
There was wonder in her voice. She hadn't expected to see the place intact. Somewhere after Tohunga, she'd given up hoping for anything at all. "Sure, Marty's competent," Tim said. "He's got the shutters up and the..." His voice trailed off. Eileen followed Tim's look. There were 2 men coming out of the observatory. Older men, about 50. They carried rifles. They watched as Tim brought the Blazer to a halt in front of the big concrete porch. Their rifles were held cradled in their arms, not quite pointing at the Blazer, not pointed away, either.
"Sorry, Jum. No room," one of the men called. "Best move on. Sorry."
Tim stared at the strangers, letting his rage gather strength. He let them have it between the eyes.
"I'm Tim Hamner. I own this place. Now who are you?"
They didn't react at all. A younger man came out onto the porch.
"Marty!"
Tim screamed.
"Marty, tell them who I am!"
"And when I learn what these strangers are doing here," he didn't say, "I'll have words with you, Marty." Marty smiled broadly.
"Larry, Fritz, this is Mr. Timothy Gardner Allington Hamner, playboy, millionaire. Oh yes, and amateur astronomer. He owns this place."
"Think of that,"
Fritz said. The rifle didn't waver. One of the boys began to cry. Eileen pulled him toward herself and hugged him. The other children watched with big eyes. Tim opened the door of the blazer. The rifles moved, fractionally. Tim ignored them and got out. He stood in the dusky twilight. Rain soaked his clothing and ran down the back of his neck. He walked toward the porch. "Better not," one of the riflemen, the one called Larry, said. "The hell with you," Tim said. He climbed the steps onto the porch. "I am not going to shout at you and scare the children." The men did nothing, and for a moment Tim felt courage. Maybe, was it all a joke? He looked at Marty Robbins. "What's happening here?"
"Not here," Marty said. "Everywhere."
"I know about Hammerfall. What are these people doing at my place?" A mistake, Tim realized instantly. Too late.
"It's not your place," Marty Robbins said. "You can't get away with this. There are rangers down there. They'll be here as soon as they can get..."
"No, they won't," Robbins said. "No rangers, no army, no National Guard, no police. You've got good radio equipment here, Mr. Hamner." He said the Mr. contemptuously. "I heard the last Apollo messages, and the rest of it, too. I heard what the rangers told each other. You don't own this place, because nobody owns anything anymore, and we don't need you."
"But," Tim examined the other two men, "they didn't look like criminals."
"How the hell do you know what a criminal looks like?" Tim wondered. But they didn't. Their hands were clean, rough, like workmen's hands, not like Marty Robbins's hands, or Tim's. One of the men had broken a nail off close, and it was just growing back. They wore gray trousers, work clothes. There was a label on Fritz's pants, Big Smith. "Why are you doing this?" Tim asked them. He ignored Robbins now.
"What else can we do?"
Larry asked. There was pleading in his voice, but the rifle was held steady, pointing somewhere between Tim and the blazer.
"There's not a lot of food here, but some. Enough for a while. We have families here, Mr. Hamner. What can we do?"
"You can stay. Just let us..."
"But don't you see, we can't let you stay," Larry said. "What can you do here, Mr. Hamner? What are you good for now?"
"How the hell do you know what I can—"
"We discussed this before," Fritz growled. "Didn't think you'd get here, but we talked about what to do if you did. And this is it. Get out. You're not needed."
Marty Robbins couldn't meet Tim's eye. Tim nodded bleakly. He understood. There wasn't a lot more to say, either. Any equipment, radios, even astronomical and meteorological gear, Robbins knew how to work as well as Tim did. Better. And Robbins had lived here for over a year. If there was anything special to know about these mountains, he'd know more of it than Tim.
"Who's the chick?"
Robbins demanded. He took a large flashlight from his pocket and shined it toward the blazer. It didn't help the visibility much. It showed raindrops falling, and the muddy car, and a glint of Eileen's hair.
"One of your relatives, rich bitch?"
"You little bastard." Tim tried to remember his assistant as he'd known him. They'd quarreled when Marty lived in Bel Air with Tim, but it hadn't been serious, and Robbins was excellent at the observatory. Not a month ago, 3 weeks ago, Tim had written a letter recommending Robbins to the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. "I guess I really never knew."
"She can stay," Robbins was saying. "We're a woman short. She can stay. Not you. I'll go tell her."
"You'll ask her," Larry said.
"Ask. She can stay if she wants to."
"And me?"
"We're going to watch you drive away," Larry said. "Don't come back." "There are some rangers out there," Marty Robbins said. "Maybe it's not such a good idea. Maybe we shouldn't let him have the car. That's a good car. Better than anything we have here."
"Don't talk like that."
Larry's voice dropped, and he glanced behind at the door into the observatory. Tim frowned. Something was happening here, and he didn't understand it. Eileen got out of the blazer and came up onto the porch. Her voice was wooden, exhausted.
"What's wrong, Tim?"
"They say this isn't my place anymore.
They're sending us away.
You can stay, Marty said.
You can't do this,
Eileen screamed.
Shut up,
Larry shouted. An ample woman came out of the observatory. She looked at Larry with a frown.
What is this?
Keep out of this, Larry said.
Larry Kelly, what are you doing?
The woman demanded.
Who are these people? I know him. He was on the Tonight Show. Timothy Hamner. This was your place, wasn't it?
It is my place.
No, Fritz said. We agreed. No.
Thieves. Thieves and murderers, Eileen said. Why don't you just shoot us and be done with it?
Tim wanted to shout to her, to tell her to shut up. Suppose they did it. Robbins would.
There's no call to say things like that, the woman said.
It's simple. There's not enough here for all of us. Not for long. More people there are, the less there is, and we don't need Mr. Hamner giving orders, and I don't reckon he's good for a lot else. Not any more. You go find another place, Mr. Hamner. There's other places to go.
She looked to Larry for confirmation.
We'll have to move on pretty soon ourselves. You'll just have a head start.
She sounded thoroughly sane and reasonable. It was a nightmare for Tim. She sounded calm and reasonable, and her tone indicated that she was sure Tim would agree.
But the girl can stay, Robbins said again.
Do you want to? Tim asked. Eileen laughed. It was a bitter laugh, full of contempt. She looked at Marty Robbins and laughed again.
There are children in that car, the woman said.
Mary Sue, they're no business of ours, Fritz said.
She ignored him. She looked to Larry.
Who are those children?
From the camp, Eileen said. They lived in Los Angeles. The Rangers didn't have anything to feed them. We brought them. We thought...
The woman left the porch and went down to the blazer. You tell her no, Fritz said. You make her...
I haven't been able to make her do anything for 15 years, Larry said. You know that.
Yeah.
We don't need kids here, Marty Robbins shouted.
Don't reckon they'll eat as much between them as this lady would, Larry said.
He turned to Tim and Eileen.
Look, Mr. Hamner, you see how it is. We got nothing against you, but...
But you're leaving,
Marty Robbins said. There was satisfaction in his voice. He let it drop so that the woman couldn't hear. She had gotten into the car and was sitting in the back seat, talking with the children.
I still say there are Rangers out there. Hamner might find one.
Tell you what, I'll go along with him when he leaves.
No,
Larry was clearly disgusted.
Maybe he should, Fritz said.
Way he thinks, I'm not sure we ever want to have him behind us. Maybe he should go and not come back. We could tough it out without him.
We made a deal, Marty cried. When you came here, I let you in. We made a deal.
Sure we did, Fritz said. But you better shut up about murder, or we may forget that deal.
I see Mary Sue's bringing the kids.
You want us to keep them, Mr. Hamner?
So damned calm, Tim thought. Fritz and Larry. Two what? Carpenters? Landscape gardeners? Survivors now, convincing themselves they were still civilized people.
Since there's no gas left in the car, and Eileen and I aren't likely to get out of the mountains alive, it would be a good idea.
Eileen, staying here might be your...
Not with that.
She was looking at Robbins. Fritz looked at Larry. They stared at each other for a moment.
I guess we've got a little gas, Fritz said.
10-gallon can, anyway.
You can have that. 10 gallons of gas and a couple cans of soup. Now get back in that car before we change our minds about the gas.
Tim got back in the car, pulling Eileen along before she could make any more suggestions. The children were clustered around Mary Sue, but they were looking toward the car, and that scared look was going to be on their faces a lot from now on. Tim dredged up a reassuring smile and a wave. His fingers twitched with the need to get going, get away from those guns, but he waited. Larry filled their tank. Tim backed out of the drive and drove off into the rain.
The Mailman. 1. Everything that is called duty, the prerequisite for all genuine law and the substance of every noble custom can be traced back to honor. If one has to think about it, one is already without honor. Oswald Spengler, Faults. Harry Newcomb saw nothing of Hammerfall, and it was Jason Gilcuddy's fault. Gilcuddy had imprisoned himself in the wilderness, he said, to diet and to write a novel. He had dropped 12 pounds in 6 months, but he could afford more. As for his isolation, it was certain that he would rather talk to a passing postman than write. As the best coffee cup was to be found at the Silver Valley Ranch, so Gilcuddy, on the other side of the valley, made the best coffee. But, Harry told him, smiling, I'd slosh if I let everyone feed me 2 cups. I'm popular, I am. Kid, you'd better take it. My lease is up come Thursday, and Ballad's finished. Next trash day, I'll be gone. Finished! Hey, beautiful! Am I in it? No, I'm sorry, Harry, but the damn thing was getting too big. You know how it is. What you like best is usually what has to go. But the coffee's Jamaica Blue Mountain. When I celebrate... Yeah, pour. Shot of brandy? Have some respect for the uniform, if you... Well, hell, I can't pour it out, can I? To my publisher, Gilcuddy raised his cup carefully. He said, if I didn't fulfill his contract, he'd put out a contract on me. Tough business. Well, but the money's good. A distant thunderclap registered at the back of Harry's mind. Summer storm coming. He sipped at his coffee. It really was something special. But there were no thunderclouds when he walked outside. Harry had been up before dawn. The valley farmers kept strange hours, and so did postmen. He had seen the pearly glow of the comet's tail wrapping the earth. Some of that glory still clung, softening the direct sunlight and whiting the blue of the sky. Like smog, but clean. There was a strange stillness, as if the day were waiting for something. So it was back to Chicago for Jason Gilcuddy until the next time he had to imprison himself to diet and write a novel. Harry would miss him. Jason was the most literate man in the valley, possibly excepting the senator, who was real. Harry had seen him from a distance yesterday, arriving in a vehicle the size of a bus. Maybe they'd meet today. He was driving briskly along toward the Adams place when the truck began to shake. He braked. Flat tire. Damage to a wheel? The road shuddered and seemed to twist. The truck was trying to shake his brains out. He got it stopped. It was still shaking. He turned off the ignition. Still shaking. I should have looked at that brandy bottle. Huh. Earthquake? The tremors died away. There aren't any fault lines around here, I thought. He drove on more slowly. The Adams farm was a long jog on the new route he'd planned to get him there early. He didn't dare go up to the house, and that would save him a couple of minutes. There had been no new complaints from Mrs. Adams, but he hadn't seen Donna in weeks. Harry took off his sunglasses. The day had darkened without his noticing. It was still darkening, clouds streaming across the sky like a speeded-up movie, lightning flashing in their dark bellies. Harry had never seen anything like it. Summer storm, right. It was going to rain. The wind howled like demons breaking through from hell. The sky had gone from ugly to hideous. Harry had never seen anything like these roiling black clouds sputtering with lightning. It would have served Mrs. Adams right, he thought vindictively, if he had left her mail in the box outside the gate. But it might be Donna who would have to make the soggy trip. Harry drove up and parked under the porch overhang. As he got out, the rain came, and the overhang was almost no protection. The wind whipped rain in all directions. And it might have been Donna who answered the door, but it wasn't. Mrs. Adams showed no sign of pleasure at seeing him. Harry raised his voice above the storm. "Your mail, Mrs. Adams!" His voice as cold as her face. "Thank you," she said, and closed the door firmly. The rain poured from the sky like 1,000 bathtubs emptying, and washed from the truck in filthy brown streams. It shamed Harry. He hadn't guessed that the truck was that dirty. He climbed in, half-soaked already, and drove off. Was weather like this common in the valley? Harry had been here just over a year, and he'd seen nothing remotely like this. Noah's flood. He badly wanted to ask someone about it. Anyone but Mrs. Adams. This had been the dry season in the valley. Carper Creek had been way down, a mere ripple of water wetting the bottoms of the smooth white boulders that formed its bed, as late as this morning. But when Harry Newcomb drove across the wooden bridge, the creek was beating against the bottom and washing over the upstream edge. The rain still fell with frantic urgency. Harry pulled way over to put two envelopes in Gentry's mailbox. The only time he had ever seen Gentry, the farmer had been pointing a shotgun at him. Gentry was a hermit, and his need for up-to-the-minute mail was not urgent, and Harry didn't like him. His wheels spun disconcertingly before they caught and pulled him back on the road. Sooner or later, he would get stuck. He had given up hope of finishing his route today. Maybe he could beg a meal and a couch from the millers. Now the road led steeply uphill. Harry drove in low gear, half blind in the rain and the lightning and the blackness between. Presently there was empty space on his left, a hillside on his right, trees covering both. Harry hugged the hillside. The cab was thoroughly wet, the air warm and 110% humid. Harry braked sharply. The hillside had slipped. It ran right across the road and on down, studded with broken and unbroken trees. Briefly, Harry considered going back, but it was back toward Gentry's and then the Adamses, and the hell with it. The rain had already washed part of the mudslide away. What was left wasn't all that steep. Harry drove up the mud lip, first gear and keep it moving. If he bogged down, it would be a wet walk home. The truck lurched. Harry used wheel and accelerator, biting his lower lip. No use. The mud itself was sliding. He had to get off. He floored the accelerator. The wheels spun futilely. The truck tilted. Harry turned off the ignition and dove for the floorboards and covered his face with his arms. The truck gently rocked and swung like a small boat at anchor, swung too far and turned on its side. Then it smashed into something massive, wheeled around, and struck something else, and stopped moving. Harry lifted his head. A tree trunk had smashed the windshield. The frosted safety glass bowed inward before it. That tree and another now wedged the truck in place. It lay on the passenger side, and it wasn't coming out without a lot of help. At least a tow truck and men with chainsaws. Harry was hanging from the seat belt. Gingerly, he unfastened it, decided he wasn't hurt. And now what? He wasn't supposed to leave the mail unguarded, and he couldn't sit here all day. "How am I going to finish the route?" he asked himself, and giggled, because it was pretty obvious that he wasn't going to get that done today. He would have to let the mail pile up until tomorrow. The wolf would be furious, and Harry couldn't help that. He took the registered letter for Senator Jellison and slipped it into his pocket. There were a couple of small packets that Harry thought might be valuable, and he put them in another pocket. The big stuff, books, and the rest of the mail would just have to take care of itself. He started out into the rain. It drove into his face, blinding him, soaking him in an instant. The mud slipped beneath his feet, and in seconds he was clutching wildly at a small tree to keep from falling into the rapidly rising creek far below. He stood there a long moment. No, he wasn't going to get to a telephone. Not through that. Better to wait it out. Luckily, he was back on his charted route again. The wolf would know where to look for him. Only Harry couldn't think of any vehicle that could reach him. Not through that. Lightning flared above him, a double flash. Blink, blink. Thunder exploded instantly. He felt a distinct tingle in his wet feet. Close. Painfully, he made his way back to the truck and got inside. It wasn't insulated from the ground, but it seemed the safest place to wait out the lightning storm, and at least he hadn't left the mail unguarded. That had worried him. Better to deliver it late than let it be stolen. Definitely better, he decided, and tried to make himself comfortable. The hours wore on, and there was no sign of the storm letting up. Harry slept badly. He made a nest back in the cargo compartment, sacrificing some shopping circulars and his morning newspaper. He woke often, always hearing the endless drumming of rain on metal. When earth and sky turned from lightning-lit black to dull gray with less lightning, Harry squirmed around and searched out yesterday's carton of milk. A premonition of need had made him leave it until now. It wasn't enough. He was famished, and he missed his morning coffee. "Next place," he told himself, and imagined a big mug of hot, steaming coffee, perhaps with a bit of brandy in it, although no one but Gil Cuddy was going to offer him that. The rain had slackened off a bit, and so had the howling wind. "Or else I'm going deaf," he said. "Going deaf! Well, maybe not." Cheerful by nature, he was quick to find the one bright point in a gloomy situation. "Good thing it isn't trash day," he told himself. He took his feet out of the leather mail bag where they'd stayed near dry during the long night, and put his boots back on. Then he looked at the mail. There was barely enough light. "First class only," he told himself. "Leave the books." He wondered about Senator Jellison's congressional record and the magazines. He decided to take them. Eventually, he had stuffed his bag with everything except the largest packages. He stood and wrestled the driver's door open, trapdoor fashion, and pushed the mail bag out onto the side, now the top of the truck. Then he climbed out after it. The rain was still falling, and he spread a piece of plastic over the top of the mail bag. The truck shifted uneasily. Mud had piled along the high side of the truck, level with the wheels. Harry shouldered the bag and started uphill. He felt his footing shift, and he sprinted uphill. Behind him, the trees bowed before the weight of truck and shifting mud. Their roots pulled free, and the truck rolled, gathering speed. Harry shook his head. This was probably his last circuit. Wolf wouldn't like losing a truck. Harry started up the uneasy mud slope, looking about him as he went. He needed a walking stick. Presently, he found a tilted sapling, 5 feet long and supple, that came out of the mud by its loosened roots. Marching was easier after he reached the road. He was going downhill, back from the long detour to the Adamses. The heavy mud washed off his boots and his feet grew lighter. The rain fell steadily. He kept looking upslope, alert for more mudslides. 5 pounds of water in my hair alone, he groused. Keeps my neck warm, though. The pack was heavy. A hip belt would have made carrying it easier. Presently, he began to sing. I went out to take a friggin' walk by the friggin' reservoir, a-wishin' for a friggin' quid to pay my friggin' score. My head it was a-achin', and my throat was parched and dry, and so I sent a little prayer a-wingin' to the sky. He topped the slight rise and saw a blasted transmission tower. High-tension wires lay across the road. The steel tower had been struck by lightning, perhaps several times, and seemed twisted at the top. How long ago? And why weren't the Edison people out to fix it? Harry shrugged. Then he noticed the telephone lines. They were down, too. He wouldn't be calling in from his next stop. And there came a friggin' falcon, and he walked upon the waves. And I said a friggin' miracle, and sang a couple staves of a friggin' churchy ballad I learned when I was young. The friggin' bird took to the air and spattered me with dung. I fell upon my friggin' knees and bowed my friggin' head, and said 3 friggin' aves for all my friggin' dead. And then I got upon my feet and said another 10. The friggin' bird burst into flame and spattered me again. There was the Miller's Gate. He couldn't see anyone. There were no fresh ruts in their drive. Harry wondered if they'd gone out last night. They certainly hadn't made it out today. He sank into deep mud as he went up the long drive toward the house. They wouldn't have a phone, but maybe he could bum a cup of coffee, even a ride into town.
The burning bird hung in the sky just like a friggin' sun. It seared my friggin' eyelids shut, and when the job was done, the friggin' bird flashed across the sky just like a shootin' star. I ran to tell the friggin' priest. He bummed my last cigar. I told him of the miracle. He told me of the rose. I showed him bird crap in my hair. The bastard held his nose. I went to see the bishop, but the friggin' bishop said, "Go home and sleep it off, you sod, and wash your friggin' head."
No one answered his knock at the miller's front door. The door stood slightly ajar. Harry called in, loudly, and there was still no answer. He smelled coffee. He stood a moment, then fished out two letters and a copy of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, pushed the door open, and went inside, mail held like an ambassador's passport. He sang loudly,
"Then I came upon a friggin' wake for a friggin' rotten swine, by the name of Jock O'Leary, and I touched his head with mine. And old Jock sat up in his box and raised his friggin' head. His wife took out a .44 and shot the bastard dead. Again I touched his head with mine and brought him back to life. His smiling face rolled on the floor. This time she used a knife. And then she fell upon her knees and started in to pray. 'It's 40 years, O Lord,' she said, 'I've waited for this day.'"
He left the mail on the front room table where he usually piled stuff on trash day, then wandered toward the kitchen, led by the smell of coffee. He continued to sing loudly, lest he be shot as an intruder.
"So I walked the friggin' city amongst the friggin' halt and lame, and every time I raised 'em up, they got knocked down again. 'Cause the love of God comes down to man in a friggin' curious way. But when a man is marked for love, that love is here to stay.'"
There was coffee. The gas stove was working, and there was a big pot of coffee on it, and three cups set out. Harry poured one full. He sang in triumph,
"And this I know, because I've got a friggin' curious sign. For every time I wash my head, the water turns to wine. And I gives it free to workin' blokes to brighten up their lives, so they don't kick no dogs around, nor beat up on their wives."
He found a bowl of oranges, resisted temptation for a full 10 seconds, then took one. He peeled it as he walked on through the kitchen to the back door, out into the orange groves behind. The millers were natives, they'd know what was happening, and they had to be around somewhere.
"'Cause there ain't no use to miracles like walking on the sea. They crucified the Son of God, but they don't muck with me. 'Cause I leave the friggin' blind alone, the dying and the dead. But every day at 4 o'clock, I wash my friggin' head.'"
"Oh, Harry!"
a voice called. Somewhere to his right, Harry went through heavy mud and orange trees. Jack Miller and his son Roy and daughter-in-law Cecilia were harvesting tomatoes in full panic. They'd spread a large tarp on the ground and were covering it with everything they could pick, ripe and half-green.
"They'll rot on the ground," Roy puffed. "Gotta get them inside. Quick, could sure use help."
Harry looked at his muddy boots, mailbag, sodden uniform.
"You're not supposed to stay me," he said. "It's against government regulations."
"Yeah. Say, Harry, what's going on out there?"
Roy demanded.
"You don't know."
Harry was appalled.
"How could we? Phone's been out since yesterday afternoon. Power out. No TV. Can't get a damn thing. Sorry, sissy. Get nothing but static on the transistor radio. What's it like in town?"
"Haven't been to town," Harry confessed. "Truck's dead. Couple miles toward the gentry place. Since yesterday. Spent the night in the truck."
"Hmm."
Roy stopped his frantic picking for a moment.
"Sissy, better get in and get to canning. Just the ripe ones. Harry, I'll make you a deal. Breakfast, lunch, a ride into town, and I don't tell nobody about what you were singing inside my house. You help us the rest of the day."
"Well, I'll drive you and put in a good word," Sissy said.
The millers carried some weight in the valley. The wolf might not fire him for losing the truck if he had a good word.
"I can't get in any quicker by walking," Harry said. "It's a deal."
He set to work. They didn't talk much. They needed their breath. Presently, Sissy brought out sandwiches. The millers hardly stopped long enough to eat. Then they went back to it. When they did talk, it was about the weather. Jack Miller had seen nothing like it in his 52 years in the valley.
"Comet," Sissy said. "It did this."
Nonsense, Roy said. You heard the TV. It missed us by thousands of miles.
It did. Good, Harry said.
We didn't hear that it missed. Heard it was going to miss, Jack Miller said. He went back to harvesting tomatoes. When they got those picked, there were beans and squashes. Harry had never worked so hard in his life. He realized suddenly it was getting late afternoon.
Hey, I have got to get to town, he insisted.
Yeah, okay. Sissy, Jack Miller called. Take the pickup. Get by the feed store. We're going to need lots of cattle and hog feed. Damned rain's battered down most of the fodder. Better get feed before everybody else thinks of it. Price'll be sky high in a week.
If there's any place to buy it in a week, Sissy said.
What do you mean by that? Her husband demanded.
Nothing. She went off to the barn, tight jeans bulging, water dripping from her hat. She came out with the Dodge pickup. Harry squeezed into the seat, mailbag on his lap to protect it from the rain. He'd left it in the barn while he worked. The truck had no trouble with the muddy drive. When they got to the gate, Sissy got out. Harry couldn't move with the big mailbag. She laughed at him when she got back in. They hadn't gone half a mile when the road ended in a gigantic crack. The road had pulled apart, and the hillside with it, and tons of sloppy mud had come off the hillside to cover the road beyond the crack. Harry studied it carefully. Cecilia backed and twisted to turn the truck around. Harry started toward the ruined road. "You're not going to walk," she said.
"Mail must go through," Harry muttered. He laughed. "Didn't finish the route yesterday."
"Harry, don't be silly. There will be a road crew out today. Tomorrow, for sure. Wait for that. You won't get to town before dark, maybe not at all in this rain. Come back to the house."
He thought about that. What she said made sense. Power lines down, roads out, telephone lines out. Somebody would come through here. The mailbag seemed terribly heavy. "All right."
They put him back to work, of course. He'd expected that. They didn't eat until after dark, but it was an enormous meal, suitable for farmhand appetites. Harry couldn't stay awake and collapsed on the couch. He didn't even notice when Jack and Roy took his uniform off him and covered him with a blanket.
Harry woke to find the house empty. His uniform, hung to dry, was still soggy. Rain pounded relentlessly on the farmhouse. He dressed and found coffee. While he was drinking it, the others came in. Cecilia made a breakfast of ham and pancakes and more coffee. She was strong and tall, but she looked tired now. Roy kept eyeing her anxiously.
"I'm all right," she said. "Not used to doing men's work and my own, too."
"We got most of it in," Jack Miller said. "Never saw rain like this, though."
There was a softness, a wondering in Jack Miller's voice that might have been superstitious fear.
"Those bastards at the Weather Bureau never gave us a minute's warning. What are they doing with all those shiny weather satellites?"
"Maybe the comet knocked them out," Harry said. Jack Miller glared.
"Comet? Humph! Comets are things in the sky. Live in the 20th century, Harry."
"I tried it once. I like it better here." He got a soft smile from Sissy. He liked it.
"I'd best be on my way," he said.
"In this?" Roy Miller was incredulous. "You can't be serious."
Harry shrugged.
"Got my route to finish."
The others looked guilty.
"Reckon we can run you down to where the road's out," Jack Miller said. "Maybe a work crew got in already."
"Thanks."
There wasn't any work crew. More mud had slid off the hillside during the night.
"Wish you'd stay," Jack said. "Can use the help."
"Thanks. I'll let people in town know how it is with you."
"Right. Thanks. Good luck."
"Yeah."
It was just possible to pick his way across the crack, over the mudslide. The heavy mailbag dragged at his shoulder. It was leather, waterproof, with the plastic over the top.
Just as well, Harry thought. All that paper could soak up 20 or 30 pounds of water. It would make it much harder.
"Make it hard to read the mail, too," Harry said aloud.
He trudged on down the road, slipping and sliding, until he found another sapling to replace the one he'd left at the Miller's place. It had too many roots at the bottom, but it kept him upright.
"This is the pits," Harry shouted into the rain-laden wind.
Then he laughed and added, "But it's gotta be farm work." The rain had stopped Harry's watch. He thought it was just past 11 when he reached the gate of the Shire. It was almost 2. He was back in flat country now, out of the hills. There had been no more breaks in the road, but there was always the water and the mud. He couldn't see the road anywhere. He had to infer it from the shape of the glistening, mud-covered landscape. Soggy everywhere, dimly aware of the chafe spots developing beneath his clinging uniform, moving against the resistance of his uniform and the mud that clung to his boots, Harry thought he had made good time, considering. He still hoped to finish his route in somebody's car. It wasn't likely he'd find a ride at the Shire, though. He had seen nobody while he walked along the Shire's split-log fence. Nobody in the fields, nobody trying to save whatever crops the Shire was growing. Were they growing anything? Nothing Harry recognized, but Harry wasn't a farmer. The gate was sturdy, the padlock on it was new and shiny and big. Harry found the mailbox bent at 45 degrees, as if a car had hit it. The box was full of water. Harry was annoyed. He carried 8 letters for the Shire and a thick, lumpy manila envelope. He threw back his head and hollered, "Hey in there! Mail call!" The house was dark. Power out here, too. Or had Hugo Beck and his score of strange guests all tired of country life and gone away? The Shire was a commune. Everyone in the valley knew that, and few knew more. The Shire let the valley people alone. Harry, in his privileged occupation, had met Hugo Beck and a few of the others. Hugo had inherited the spread from his aunt and uncle 3 years ago, when they racked up their car on a Mexico vacation. It had been called something else then, Inverted Fork Ranch, some such name, probably named after a branding iron. Hugo Beck had arrived for the funeral, a pudgy boy of 18 who wore his straight black hair at shoulder length and a fringe of beard with the chin bared. He'd looked the place over and stayed to sell the cattle and most of the horses and left. A month later he'd returned, followed by, the number varied according to who was talking, a score of hippies. There was enough money somehow to keep them alive and fairly comfortable. Certainly the Shire was not a successful business. It exported nothing. But they must be growing some food. They didn't import enough from town. Harry hollered again. The front door opened, and a human shape strolled down to the gate. It was Tony. Harry knew him, scrawny and sun-darkened, grinning to show teeth that had been straightened in youth. Tony was dressed as usual, jeans, wool vest, no shirt, digger hat, and sandals. He looked at Harry through the gate.
"Hey, man, what's happening?"
The rain affected him not at all.
"The picnic's been called off. I came to tell you."
Tony looked blank, then laughed.
"The picnic? Hey, that's funny. I'll tell them. They're all huddling in the house. Maybe they think they'll melt." "I'm half melted already. Here's your mail."
Harry handed it over.
"Your mailbox is wrecked."
"It won't matter." Tony seemed to be grinning at some private joke. Harry skipped it.
"Can you spare someone to run me into town? I wrecked my truck."
"Sorry, we want to save the gas for emergencies." What did he think this was? Harry held his temper.
"Such is life. Can you spare me a sandwich?"
"Nope. Famine coming. We gotta think of ourselves."
"I don't get you."
Harry was beginning to dislike Tony's grin.
"The hammer has fallen," said Tony. "The establishment is dead. No more draft, no more taxes, no more wars, no more going to jail for smoking pot, no more having to pick between a crook and an idiot for president."
Tony grinned beneath the shapeless, soggy hat.
"No more trash day, either. I thought I'd flipped when I saw a mailman at the gate."
Tony really had flipped, Harry realized. He tried to sidestep the issue.
"Can you get Hugo Beck down here?"
"Maybe." Harry watched Tony re-enter the farmhouse. Was there anyone alive in there?
Tony had never struck him as dangerous, but if he stepped out with anything remotely like a rifle, Harry was going to run like a deer. Half a dozen of them came out. One girl was in rain gear. The rest seemed to be dressed for swimming. Maybe that made a kind of sense. You couldn't hope to stay dry in this weather. Harry recognized Tony and Hugo Beck and the broad-shouldered, broad-hipped girl who called herself Galadriel, and a silent giant whose name he'd never learned. They clustered at the gate, hugely amused. Harry asked, "What's it all about?" Much of Hugo's fat had turned to muscle in the past 3 years, but he still didn't look like a farmer. Maybe it was the expensive sandals and worn swim trunks, or maybe it was the way he lounged against the gate, exactly as Jason Gilcuddy the writer would lounge against his bar, leaving one hand free to gesture.
"Hammerfall," said Hugo. "You could be the last mailman we ever see. Consider the implications. No more ads to buy things you can't afford. No more friendly reminders from the collection agency. You should throw away that uniform, Harry. The establishment's dead."
"The comet hit us?"
"Right."
"Huh." Harry didn't know whether to believe it or not. There had been talk, but a comet was nothing. Dirty vacuum lit by unfiltered sunlight. Very pretty when seen from a hilltop with the right girl beside you. This rain, though. What about the rain?
"Huh. So I'm a member of the establishment."
"That's a uniform, isn't it?"
said Beck, and the others laughed. Harry looked down.
"Somebody should have told me. All right, you can't feed me, and you can't transport me."
"No more gas. Maybe forever. The rain is going to wipe out most of the crops. You can see that, Harry."
"Yeah. Can you loan me a hatchet for 15 minutes?
"Tony, get the hatchet."
Tony jogged up to the farmhouse. Hugo asked,
"What are you going to do with it?"
"Trim the roots off my walking stick."
"What then?"
He didn't have to answer because Tony was back with the hatchet. Harry went to work. The Shire people watched. Presently Hugo asked again,
"What do you do now?"
"Deliver the mail," said Harry.
"Why?"
a frail and pretty blonde girl cried.
"It's all over, man. No more letters to your congressman, no more Playboy, no more tax forms or voting instructions. You're free. Take off the uniform and dance."
"I'm already cold. My feet hurt."
"Have a hit."
The silent giant was handing a generously fat homemade cigarette through the gate, shielding it with Tony's digger hat. Harry saw the others' disapproval, but they said nothing, so he took the toke. He held his own hat over it while he lit it and drew. Were they growing the weed here? Harry didn't ask, but...
"You'll have trouble getting papers."
They looked at each other. That hadn't occurred to them.
"Better save that last batch of letters. No more trash day."
Harry passed the hatchet back through the bars.
"Thanks. Thanks for the toke, too."
He picked up the trimmed sapling. It felt lighter, better balanced. He got his arm through the mailbag strap.
"Anyway, it's the mail. Neither rain nor sleet nor heat of day nor gloom of night, etc."
"What does it say?" Hugo Beck asked. "About the end of the world?"
"I think it's optional. I'm going to deliver the mail."
The Mailman 2. Among the deficiencies common to the Italian and the U.S. postal systems are inefficiency and delays in deliveries, old-fashioned organization, low efficiency and low salaries of personnel, high frequency of strikes, very high operational deficit. Roberto Vacca, The Coming Dark Age. Carrie Roman was a middle-aged widow with two big sons who were Harry's age and twice Harry's size. Carrie was almost as big as they were. Three jovial giants, they formed one of Harry's coffee stops. Once before, they had given Harry a lift to town to report a breakdown of the mail truck. Harry reached their gate in a mood of bright optimism. The gate was padlocked, of course, but Jack Roman had rigged a buzzer to the house. Harry pushed it and waited. The rain poured over him, gentle, inexorable. If it had started raining up from the ground, Harry doubted he would notice. It was all of his environment, the rain. Where were the Romans? Hell, of course, they had no electricity. Harry pushed the buzzer again, experimentally. From the corner of his eye, he saw someone crouched low, sprinting from behind a tree. The figure was only visible for an instant, then bushes hid it. But it carried something the shape of a shovel or a rifle, and it was too small to be one of the Romans. "Mail call!" Harry cried cheerily. What the hell was going on here? The sound of a gunshot matched